March 23rd, 2017, Masoret. Yesterday we were discussing the concept of the mirrors that the women donated. The Nushim Hatzovos, you know, that gathered. So that's very, very cryptic, but there's an indication that there's something unique over here. That, you know, the Torah doesn't go into all the details. But, of course, the question arises, what's it referring to? And what's unique about this? So, you know, we saw the plame shot, the Ibn Ezra. So we took up the Ibn Ezra mentioned that, and it seems the Ramban agreed that the Torah is pointing something out to us, that the women, so to speak, elevated themselves and reached a level where they, you know, separated themselves from that natural connection or attraction to the whole idea of the vanity. The mirror represents vanity. All right. So we went through that idea. But Rashi brings down the a very, very interesting story. It's a midrashic approach, which talks about, to me, it's a completely different angle. Because it's really, I guess, a surprise. It's surprising that Rashi would bring it down. You know, it's the kind of thing you don't talk about, that how the women entice the men using the mirrors because of the situation in Mitzrayim. And it's the kind of thing, I guess, a person, or the average religious person, you know, has certain emotional reactions that are sort of, you know, that he's geared to. And that since it appeals to the sexual imagination, so it's something that the person's uncomfortable with. I mean, assuming, of course, he's religious, and the religious emotions that he's developed make him uncomfortable. At least from that perspective, he personally may not object, but he's not going to say it publicly because he knows he's aware of that reaction. So that emotional reaction would lead him to shy away from that. That's not nice. That's not nice. So therefore, what there's a big teaching over here. And that the women brought those mirrors. Apparently, if they brought it, then they must have thought that there was a certain nobility in it. And that is that they utilized that element or that approach, that they utilized it. They weren't ashamed. And as a result, because it was as a result of that, they performed a great service or a great mitzvah, whatever you want to say. So then it becomes a question, can that be incorporated into the system, so to speak? The idea that in certain circumstances, this kind of a behavior, I'm not saying, by the way, I don't know that there's anything wrong with the behavior altogether. I don't mean to imply that that this was only permitted in Mitzrayim because of the dire circumstances, but that in ordinary situations between husband and wife, that this would not be right. I'm not implying that at all. And I'm not going into that offhand. Husband and wife have great leeway in terms of, I'm not saying they could do anything and everything, but there's a great deal of leeway in terms of enticing one another and so on and so forth. Well, that's not our subject. But this type of a thing, the use of the mirrors and sort of game playing is the way it seems to me, there's nothing wrong with it, as far as I can see. Except, it's not, again, there's an element, see what's significant over here is that there's an element of tzinius, of modesty. So what goes on in people's bedrooms is not to be shared. there's an element of tznius. Even if the things are permitted halachically, that's not the point, but it's not tznius to take it out of the bedroom, so to speak. So would you bring it into the Mishkan? That is, by accepting them and making the copper basin out of it, it's making a statement. The connotation is there. Not everybody who sees it will know, but I mean, for those who have knowledge, they'll know that it's sort of a recognition. It's sort of giving an official recognition that this was a great thing that they did. But nevertheless, it's the representation of the Yetzer Hara. So Moshe rejected it. And the response of Hashem was that, to the contrary, this is more beloved. And we did that. I tried to elucidate what it represents, and that it represents a concept of Kedusha. It's a concept of Kedusha in which man, it's not that man is separating himself, which normally we associate Kedusha with Havdalah, with separation and rising above. And so therefore the carnal, the sensual, is not part of it. But here it's different. Here it's the contrary. Here it reflects the idea that you could serve God with virtually every activity that you engage in. And we mentioned the Rambam, that if a person is living according to a certain program, that is, he's seeking to acknowledge and be in line with the goal of human existence in all of his physical areas, then every physical activity that he performs, if it's done for the right purpose, is considered to be a service of Hashem. It's an amazing concept. Like I said, I don't know of any other religion that has such a concept. Okay, that's basically the pathway that we took. And that was the subject. I wrote it up in brief in this week's Dvar Torah, which you probably have received by now. It's interesting table talk. What I wanted, though, because that's the way I approach things, that's the way we approach things, is that we seek to understand both sides. It's what we call a machlokas. And once the explanation is given, this explanation, I think, makes perfect sense. It's not really giving any kind of a license to the Yetzer Hara, only to the extent that it's the Yetzer Hara is part of reality, and it can be a good thing. That's what it shows. So then, what was the position of Moshe? Because it says that the Moshe was Moes. Which means he disparaged them. If it was left to Moshe alone, then he would not have accepted it because of the Yetzer Hara. So I don't want to attribute, any kind of, that Moshe was operating by a certain emotion, a certain from, what we would call a from emotion, that it's not nice and things of that sort. That would be wrong to say a thing like that. So if that's the case, there must be another point of view. There's a conflict then. The result that it was used is because God made that decision and overrode the position of Moshe. But there must be another legitimate, valid position. So my question is, what do you think was the position of Moshe? All right, so it's being suggested that perhaps Moshe really did not have this opinion, but the Midrash is just presenting it that way because it wanted to, so to speak, set up an opportunity that this would be a teaching, the idea that this is more beloved than everything else should come from Hashem. So therefore, it sort of uses that literary device because we need to present the situation, the context in which Hashem enters into the picture. And so therefore Moshe makes his decision, and the Midrash is merely stating that to set up that situation. So Hashem, however, does not agree with that position. The only, it's a valid thing to say. The only thing is that my sense is that where if that were actually the case, and if Moshe was neutral about it, Moshe was not opposed, then, but he wasn't sure. In other words, if you want to set up a context that this has to come from Hashem, then the Midrash could have presented it that Moshe wasn't sure. It does so in another case. For example, in the case of the Meraglim, that wasn't a simple thing. You see that was a big issue. Should we send spies into Canaan or not? I mean, you know, we just read through the parsha and it's like, okay, well, you know. But it's not such a simple thing. That is, and then we shouldn't have this thought that, you know, our Moshe knew the entire Torah and, you know, anything that came up, he always knew the answer. It's not so simple. That was something that he wasn't sure. Is it appropriate? What's the plan of Hashem? Is the plan of Hashem to lead us effortlessly into the land of Canaan and Hashem will destroy the enemies before us? Or to what extent are we supposed to utilize the ordinary tactics of invasion, operate in accordance with the natural order? And therefore, you don't just enter a country until you spy it out to whatever extent. And that became a big issue. And there were, ultimately, we see how significant it was, because that produced the second greatest calamity in the Midbar, and it delayed the entry into the land for 40 years. But Moshe was Nimloch Bashem. So it says that Moshe consulted with God. And
actually in the Chumash, though, isn't it?
I'm not saying that Moshe that this actually happened factually. I don't think I agree. Because I don't know that the rabbis had a record. They had a record of what transpired. And that it was a known thing that Moshe was opposed and then Hashem entered the picture. That I agree with. Okay. But the way they set up the Midrash was to communicate ideas. And I think that by attributing this idea to Moshe, they wanted to make that point, that the natural, ordinary response would have been to oppose it. And that's the point of view, whether Moshe actually rejected it and then Hashem overruled him, or whether that never happened, except the rabbis want to make the point. But they are making the point that this did require a special ruling from Hashem, and that there was an approach and a logic that would have rejected it because of the fact of the Yetzer Hara, and they are attributing it to Moshe. So because of that, it's incumbent upon us to seek to understand the other idea. And because the Midrash brings down that idea, it is a significant idea. In other words, it's not, if we were to just confine ourselves to understanding, you know, the maskana, so to speak, the position that God dictated in the end, and not seek to understand the idea of Moshe, then we're missing something. Because it's a valid idea. It's a valid teaching. It's just that of these two valid ideas, the one which Hashem chose to be in the Mishkan is the one that we've elucidated. But it is incumbent upon us to seek to elucidate the other idea. I guess I was browsing through the Ralbag. You know, I was looking for one thing and I found something else. But it turned out, because I was looking for direct commentary on this to see if he directly comments. The difficulty with, you know, we have a lot of commentators, but it's not always the case that they'll be commenting on the area that you're interested in, or even if they are, whether they're, you know, trying to solve the problem that you have. So that I'm not sure about. But I wanted to see if the Ralbag had anything on that. But in the meantime, I hit upon this Ralbag in Kisisa, and I want to go through it, and maybe this will shed some light. No pun, as you'll see, no pun intended. You'll understand that in a few seconds. The point is, even if it doesn't resolve this, but I think it's a worthwhile teaching in its own right. So it has to do when Moshe came down from Har Sinai, which is always an intriguing topic, and that's where the light comes in, that that there were light beams coming off of his face. Karan or Panov. His countenance was radiating light beams. That in itself is a hard thing to understand. And then as a result of that, the people were afraid to come close to him because they noticed it. And then he would put on a cover on his face. And then when Hashem spoke to him, he removed it. And when he spoke to the people, he removed it. That whole thing is very, very difficult to understand. Anyways, I want to see what the Ralbag has to say about this, which is complicated. I've read it through. Well, his language is not that easy in general. He says, "V'hine zocharach hazeh." It mentions after this, "Moshe amad bahar alaluchos hashnios," that Moshe stood on the mountain because he had destroyed the first set of luchos when he saw the Jews reveling and dancing, and then. You know, he did what he had to do in terms of punishing the sinners. And then he went back up to the mountain to pray for the people, because apparently there were other people who probably weren't liable to the death penalty. I mean, Rashi, most of the Mepharshim say that they were guilty of idolatry with the Egel, but it wasn't done there were no witnesses and so on. So they were sort of like the hidden sinners, and they needed to be punished. And he went up on the mountain to pray for them. So it says that, and then afterwards Hashem gave him the second set of luchos. So he went for 40 days and 40 nights. Okay, bezulas achilu shsiya, without eating and drinking. V'ein safek, and he says, there's no doubt, shezehu al derech apela, kederech sh'ar mosim. That is, there's no way, you can't explain this in any kind of a natural way. This is miraculous. Obviously, I don't think there's anybody that that tries to explain that in a natural way, because it's impossible for a person to go 40 days and 40 nights without food or a drink. Okay. So therefore, this was a miracle that Hashem sustained him. V'higia l'Moshe. Now here's his point. V'higia l'Moshe. Okay, Moshe attained mechozek ha-hisbodidus, from the power of the hisbodidus. Hisbodidus, in general, means seclusion, bodade. Well, it's translated lonely, but it really means to be secluded. And this was a seclusion, even though he was with Hashem, but it's a hisbodidus. Now, shekoran orpanov, that the skin of his face emitted rays, whatever that, however you translate that. Ratzolomar, that is to say, shehayelo zohar hasechel, that he had the zohar, I guess the brightness of the sechel, of the intellect, gam be'eis chashvo ladaber in Yisrael. Also at the time when he was speaking to the Jews. Okay. Achekvar hayubayim lefonav, up to the point that they would come before him, v'lo haya margish behem, and he wasn't cognizant of them. He wasn't aware of them. Chashero Yisrael zeho inyin. And when the Jews, it would appear that he has a different way of understanding it. Not so much physically, but more metaphorically. V'chashero Yisrael zeho inyin. And when the Jews saw this, in other words, the way we read the Psukim, the Jews saw the light rays, or whatever it was, whatever the physical manifestation on his face, which was unusual, and they were afraid, which is understandable. He's not learning it that way. He's learning that the Zohar HaSeichel, this brightness of the intellect, which hopefully he'll explain, accompanied Moshe. Apparently that's what Moshe had when he was before Hashem. And then when he returned to the Jews, he was still in that same state. And because he was in that state, he was not cognizant of the Jews at all. Okay, I know that this is sounds strange, and we'll have to explain it. But then what he means to say is that, what does it mean that the Jews saw Koran or Panav? What does it mean they saw that and they were afraid? In other words, they saw that he was in the state, that he was there, but he wasn't there, in a sense. He wasn't aware of them. So then they became afraid to approach him until Moshe called out to them. And then they returned to him and he spoke his words to them. V'zeh umnam haya, and that, however, was when he placed the covering on his face. So now he's going to explain, what does it mean, the covering on his face? Ratzaloma, that is to say, shesam hishtad luso, that he made an effort. He made a great effort, lahafrid zeh ha-hasbodidus, to remove this element of separation, of loneliness, of seclusiveness. Biofan, in a manner, shayuchal adaber dvarav im Yisrael, that he would be able to speak his words to Yisrael. V'ulam, however, b'vo l'fnei Hashem, Yisala, when he came before God, hoyem meisir zehamasva, he removed this covering. I think you can get a sense of where he's going. I don't think he's taking it literally, because it's a metaphor. It's talking about two completely different states. The state of Moshe Rabbeinu when he was in the presence of God, or when he experienced what the Ralbag is calling the Hisbodidus. And then when he came back, he still was in that state. And apparently when he was in that state, he was completely removed from any kind of sense of society and people and so forth. And however, when he realized that he has to change the state, so he says he had to struggle to remove the Hispodidus state in a manner, in other words, he wouldn't be able to talk to the Jews in the state that he was in. Two completely different states. Okay, so then, however, when he returned to being in the presence of God, so then he removed the covering. And he didn't need any other kind of ishtadlus effort, lagos hasbodidus lesichlo, to achieve the seclusiveness of his intellect, mibein she'ar chelkei hanefesh. Okay, I'll just leave that untranslated. Let's continue. Then he says, "Ashrei yelud isha sheyagil azos hamadrega ha'alyona v'atzuma." He says, "Fortunate is one born of woman that attains this level, this sublime level, sublime and powerful level." Manifla chelko, how wondrous is his portion. Umanoam gorolo, and how pleasant is his gorol. Then he says something. Okay, then he continues, and he says, "Vehine lo hiskamnu levayer inyan hamasve kipshuto." And behold, we have not agreed. I'm translating it literally, to explain the masve according to the plain shot. In other words, he's not explaining it as a physical cover. Because if that were kipshuto, if that were the case, lohayetzarich Moshe lahasir hamasve me'al panav v'yeis hanavua, then Moshe wouldn't have been necessary for him to remove that covering at the time that he had nevua. Okay. The way I'm understanding it is that he's saying that when Moshe ascended the mountain, so he achieved what he's calling a hisbodidus, which means a complete separation of the neshama, of the soul, from the physical. It's a completely different state. As though he were essentially, for all intents and purposes, like a malach. Disembodied, even though it's not... Well, he was separated from the senses. He was disconnected from eating and drinking. And the radiation means the full activation, actualization of his seichel. He's now a completely actualized intellectual being. And to the extent, and this is what I think he means, that he couldn't partake of the social. So when he came down, he was still in that state. He had been transformed into that state, he was in a different world. So he couldn't interact with the Jews. In order for him to be able to interact with the Jews, he had to use a tremendous effort to transform himself back into being an ordinary physical being. You know, with all of the emotions and so on, and abilities and cognizance and others, you know, totally different kind of a being. And he seems to be saying that's the masveh. The masveh would be the physical. That's a reflection of the physical. He would sort of put on his garments. The garments would reflect the fact that he would return to a state of being an ordinary mortal, with an ordinary mortal's needs and abilities and social, abilities, all of that kind of thing. And then that's how he interprets the masveh. But when he came before Hashem, he let go of the masveh. He separated himself from all of these physical things, and that's the glow of the face, so to speak. And that's how he interprets that. To do apply this on a certain level to the position of Moshe in terms of what concept of man the Mishnah should the Mishkan rather, sorry, the Mishkan should reflect. Okay, so now it's true what Jesse said before, that there's another concept, and that is to separate oneself. But I didn't want to leave it as just, you know, two conflicting ideas. One is to separate oneself, and the other one is to utilize one's instincts to serve God. But there are two ideas of perfection. Now, there is the idea, there's the idea that we talk about in Deos, you know, that a person shouldn't go to extremes, and a person should operate always in accordance with moderation, and so on and so forth. But I don't know if that applies to everyone, because, like, for example, when you see the Rambam describes the service of love. So the service of love, the way the Rambam describes it, he talks about Avraham Avinu, that doesn't seem to be the same thing, you know, like about someone who serves with moderation. I mean, it's not opposed necessarily, but it means that the person is operating on a different plane. Like every time when he's sitting, when he's standing, when he's involved in business and so on, he can't stop thinking about Hashem. He can't stop thinking about God. That's not the ordinary person. He says very few people achieve that level. But the ordinary person works on himself. And everyone has his limitations. And person tries to raise himself to, realistically speaking, the level that he's capable of reaching. And some people can have a higher level, some people can learn more, some people can't learn as much, and so on and so forth. But that's not what he's talking about in terms of an Avraham Avinu, he compares it like a person who's in love and can't stop thinking about the loved object. That's a totally different concept. Now here, you know, but not everybody can achieve it. He makes that point very, very clear. Here, it's not just, but we're talking about Moshe over here. Of course he serves out of love, but this is not the same thing, what the Ralbag is discussing. I'm just using that idea to show you that there's different concepts of perfection. And there is a concept of perfection that most people will not be able to attain. But that's not the same idea of perfection. So, for example, even though it's true that we are physical beings, and, you know, we live a life of moderation and so on and so forth, but it seems to me like, you know, the great, great people like the Vilna Gaon, most people would describe it as an extreme, that he's completely involved in the world of learning and ideas. And, you know, it's not, it's complete, total separation, virtually, from the physical activities and then the ordinary emotional gratification, because all of his energy. I mean, it's kind of like we talked about Ben Azai, that Toraso Amnoso. So you do have the concept, and by Moshe Rabbeinu too, what he is describing is a person who's not living like an ordinary physical existence anymore. He has such a state of his bodhidus. So that reflects a certain kind of an ideal. And that ideal is incorporated, we explained, in the Mishkan as well. Because you have the, if our interpretation was correct, you have that the idea of the Keruvim, which depict man in a certain way. So then the question, then we could see the other side. That is, the Mishkan is depicting a certain ideal of human perfection. So there is an ideal of human perfection, which has to do with man separating himself. That's the idea of the ability of man to separate himself and not to be held back by the sensual, and to, you know, get high, attain that highest level where he's virtually like a malach, so to speak. So if that is the case, then you wouldn't be depicting the Yetzirah, because even though it's a great deed that they did, but it's still operating with the instinctual on that level of existence. So then it's not that Moshe, you know, disparaged that. It's simply a question as to what ideal of perfection the Mishkan would reflect. Now, of course, the question is, if basically we're saying it's an ideal that very few people can attain, so what's the point? The Mishkan is for the entire nation. But I think in Judaism, we have to bear in mind that Judaism upholds certain ideals, even if it's, I guess, unattainable. It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing that, you got to be careful with this, as we said. You know, when they depict, you know, you read the stories of these great rabbis that never deviated, didn't waste a second from learning, and it can have a bad effect upon some people because it makes them feel depressed or guilty. But if you can put that aside, and you don't have that problem, because you recognize that you're judged in accordance with your level, so you don't get depressed. The question is there any benefit about knowing these things? Is there any benefit about depicting an ideal which very few people are capable of attaining, but which is nevertheless real? I mean, if nobody could attain it, then it's not an ideal. You can't put forth an ideal which is simply impossible. Then it's not an ideal. Ideal means within the framework of what of man's nature, that like nevuah, like prophecy. Most people, the overwhelming majority of people, are not going to attain prophecy. Still, we study about it, we read about it. Now, the thing is that something which is beneficial? And I would say that the Judaism says yes. That to read about individuals who were able to give up many, many pleasures, but wasn't giving up. It was simply because they rose to a higher level. It's instructive. It's instructive. It gives you a different perspective about these things, even if you're not going to be on that level, but it's going to give you a different perspective of what's truly the good and what is something merely because you imagine it. It's in your imagination. So that's beneficial. It's beneficial, and it will. You won't necessarily reach that level, but in your framework, it will elevate you because you respect that and you recognize that that really represents a very high level of existence. I guess that's what we call role models, which is very, very important in a culture. I mean, that's a very large element of the Jewish people, very significant factor in the success of Israel, the success of Jews, virtually wherever they are. They're always in the upper percentages, and in terms of intellectual pursuits, in terms of Nobel Prizes, and everybody recognizes that, in terms of being in the professions. Now, to a large extent, by the way, there was an interesting article in 2 days ago, the Wall Street Journal, by Naftali Bennett. He's a minister in the cabinet in Israel. A very interesting article. He wrote about the tremendous economic development. Israel's like among the highest in terms of startups and Intel and investments. I mean, from the economic point of view, Israel is among the top countries in the world in terms of the innovations and technologies and so forth. So he's writing about, you know, why, and it's a small country with all these problems, and yet they excel to such an extent. So he says it's basically three factors. He says it's not because we the educational system alone. He says that's good, but he says they have different layers. And interestingly enough, the second factor that he mentions is the fact that Talmud, the study of Talmud, he goes into it, you know, the way it's not like a lecturing, but, you know, two students are, you know, debating with each other and considering ideas from different points of view, and it gives them the ability to be original and to be conceptual, and so on and so forth. Hold on. Anyways, so let me finish. So he mentions that. He also mentions the army, which I think it's very interesting. We could discuss it at a different time. The experience of being in the army. And he says that really gives you tremendous training, and also you become responsible for others as you develop, you know, so you're given responsibilities and you have to make decisions, which could be life and death decisions. So he says that's an important element, and that's carried over. But it was interesting how he attributes, apparently there's a tremendous amount of Talmud learning in Israel. But I think that there's another factor that goes along with this, and that is the role model that the Jews always had, the role model or the ideal, and this affects the non-religious Jews as well, was the thinker, the Talmud Chacham, the scholar, the professional, the doctor. It always had to do with people of great intellectual achievement. That's always been, that's something that comes clearly from the Torah, even though it's spilled over and it's taken on a secular form and all of that. But that has a tremendous impact. I mean, and you see in other societies, like among the blacks and so forth, they don't have that kind of role model. Their role model is essentially the great athlete, athletics and so on and so forth. So they excel in athletics. But that's a shame. Because, and there's other people that put a tremendous emphasis on the importance of intellectual achievement. So that's why I'm saying that there is a benefit in having a certain ideal, even though very few people will reach that level. How many people will be on the level of Einstein? Yeah, but it's important that a society looks up to an Einstein. So that perhaps was the idea that Moshe was saying that the Mishkan should really depict man in terms of his the highest level that he could achieve. And that is someone who's completely immersed in the service of Hashem. And that's one. But then there's the perfection of someone who's not. Someone who's not completely immersed. Someone who doesn't attain the level of Ahava. But someone who has to really work on his emotions. And that's a different Kedusha. That's a different perfection. But I think that perfection is more, you know, relevant to the majority. So if you're looking in terms of the nation as a whole, who are not going to reach that level of being angels, then the women, the women who expressed, who utilized these emotions and expressed that perfection, that's really more beloved, because that's something which is going to apply to, you know, the bulk of the nation. And of course, as I said, and Moshe was expressing a different concept of perfection, which is a valid one. It's not that what he was saying wasn't valid. It's just that what impact is the Mishkan supposed to make? And that was the decision of Hashem.